we have habits, whether or not we intentionally do. And so we might as well think as hard as we can about designing habits that will allow us to hack our brains to the destination we want them to go in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Investing City podcast, where the goal is to get better at investing, business, and life. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It really means a lot. Without further ado, enjoy this episode. On today's episode of the Investing City podcast, we're happy to have Kanye Makabella on. Kanye is a deep thinker and he's taken an unconventional path. He was born in South Africa under apartheid, and then he and his parents moved to New York City. His parents were substitute teachers, and interestingly, he dropped out of Stanford not once, but twice. Then he decided to work on a startup. But I first came across Kanye when he was at the Collaborative Fund doing early stage investing. He's now since moved on, but it's clear that he is such a deep thinker and a kind person. We talk a lot about systems thinking, entrepreneurship, what makes good entrepreneurs, and so much more, so I hope you really enjoy this one. Enjoy this conversation with Kanye Makabella. Let's just dig in a little bit to your background. I think you have kind of a fascinating history, and can you just talk a little bit about where you were born, and then just a little bit about your background?
Sure, gladly. I was born in a township of Johannesburg in South Africa in the 80s called Soweto, the Southwest Township. I was born there in the midst of apartheid. My parents were involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, and my father actually was in exile at the time. So I was born with my mother and her parents and quickly shuttled off to Botswana, which is where my family was living. So it was an inauspicious circumstance, but one that I'm very proud of. Ended up coming to the United States in the midst of that very chaotic period in South African history, landed in New York City with my folks, where they made their way via substitute teaching. My mom was actually an ESL teacher at the Fashion Institute of Technology. My dad was a public school teacher, a substitute teacher at first, and then eventually a full-time public school teacher in chemistry. And so we ended up in the United States and lived the proverbial American dream.
Wow. So being the son of two teachers, obviously, education was probably pretty important. Was that something? Just tell us a little bit about that.
Of course. Well, it's extraordinarily important and has had a big impact on my life. And maybe I'll start somewhat in reverse order. But if I had to describe what my passion is and what I prefer to do above all, it's to teach. And I come obviously from a lineage of teachers, my parents, but also their parents and my dad's grandfather were actually all teachers. So it's in my blood, whether or not I like it. And I've spent the better part of the last 10 years teaching in some capacity or another. And right now, it's really more in the context of teaching first-time entrepreneurs how to avoid unforced errors. So how to make new mistakes is what I call them. But I was also teaching in a more formal capacity at NYU for a couple of semesters for entrepreneurship for undergrads, and have done formal teaching and informal teaching. But teaching is something that's very, very important to me. Now, before obviously I was a teacher, I was a student. And my trajectory as a student was an interesting one on two vectors. The first vector is I was once a dropout. I was once a college dropout. So my first stint at Stanford University, which is where I went for undergrad, was cut short to chase a startup dream. And so about 2.5 years into my time in undergrad, where I was studying philosophy, I dropped out to pursue a startup. And needless to say, that wasn't my parents' favorite activity over the course of my life, given their backgrounds and their point of view on the world. But it was something that at that time in my life, I really needed to pursue, and it ended up resulting in and education as well, as a student in how to start a startup, all the things one should never do when doing a startup, and how difficult it is to make something people want and to turn that into a product that can scale. And where my story as it relates to education starts and is most formative is I was fortunate to have two very, very inspirational teachers, both of whom gave me a pretty hard time, but I gave them much harder of a time. And those were my mother for fifth grade math and my father for organic chemistry and environmental chemistry. So that it all ties together and it's all part of one big happy family. But education is at center to how I think about the world, how I think about what's important to the world, and my own experiences professionally and personally over the course of my life.
Wow, I feel like I could go off in so many different directions with what you just said, but I'll basically summarize it. So you grew up in South Africa during apartheid, and your father was actually in exile, and then you came to the U.S., and then you find yourself at Stanford, and you drop out to start a startup. That's not exactly a conventional path, which is something that I absolutely love. But just, I want to back up. When you're talking about teaching and how you've been teaching and how you feel that that's one of your kind of missions, can you just tell us a little bit about maybe what are the attributes of a good teacher?
Of course. The first attribute, I think, is maybe a little bit of an unorthodox one in my vantage point. But the first attribute is to be a great listener. So ultimately, a really productive teacher is one that has a lot of empathy and can actually understand the learning journey of the student. And so if you think about the best teachers you've had, there was probably a high dose of inspiration that was the thing that was the most memorable. But in terms of what was most effective, I suspect if you really reflect on it, you'll find that it was because they actually were able to meet you where you were at in your learning journey. And what that means is there are people who have so many different ways of processing information, of figuring out how to get into flow states where they can maximize their output, really focus their energies around an area, and even frankly have passion in that given area manifest and directed in the right way. And a teacher is somebody who can be a great guide for that. And the only way you can guide that is if you're a listener. And the notion of a teacher being somebody who reads from a book in a 50-person lecture hall or even 100-person lecture hall is actually somewhat of a relic of a time where the printing press was the scarce resource. And so the book itself was the scarce resource. And since the book was the scarce resource, the teacher obviously had to read from it because that was the sort of choke point in terms of access to information. But in a world like today's, where the information itself is not the resource that's scarce, but rather it's the interpersonal connection and one person being a guide to really help direct the other person, that's where I think teaching becomes the most powerful and frankly can be peer-to-peer or can be mentor to mentee or can even be the other way around, where somebody who's supposedly the mentee can often have a lot to offer as a teacher to the mentor.
Interesting. And then I guess kind of to go on the other side of the desk, what makes a good learner?
That's a tricky one, but I think the simplest answers are twofold, one of which is the obvious one, and the other one, in my judgment, is somewhat less obvious in the entrepreneurial and the tech community, but is super obvious in the education community. And so the first one is whether or not somebody has sufficient enthusiasm and curiosity. And so inspiring and supporting and promoting native curiosity is one of the most powerful things that a teacher can do for a student and that a student can bring to bear in their work. And if you think about how exciting it was to go into a learning environment when you were single digit of whatever age, that is a sort of native curiosity that we're all born with. And given the right subject matter, can be carried on throughout the entirety of your learning journey, which should frankly be your whole life. And so that native curiosity and having that curiosity be appropriately directed is the critical piece. Now, the thing about that is it can be nurtured. It can be discovered. It can be directed. That curiosity is not something that is a static component of a personality or a static component of a learning experience. And so for a student to cultivate that curiosity, and if they find that one vector of the way they're learning about something or one vector or even a tangent about what they're learning is actually where they find themselves, where their natural curiosity is drawing them, if they have the capacity and the willingness to really dig in and go down that route, then that's actually really powerful. And then the second, which is the one that maybe is a little bit less popular to talk about, is you just got to do really hard work. And the truth about hard work is the key input on great performance, but hard work is also the key input on satisfaction. And hard work has two components to it. But the first component is really just being willing to put in the time. And so being willing to sit down and do the reading, and the first couple of minutes of that reading, or the first couple of workshopping sessions on a problem set, or the first couple of iterations of a product design or product development exercise, whatever the sort of module is where you're the student, is usually pretty terrible. But that's kind of the point. And so learning, and frankly, even this notion of insight, starts with frustration and confusion. If you're not frustrated and confused, then you're not on a learning journey, almost certainly. And so part of that hard work is perseverance and being willing to get through that to a point of breakthrough. And so hard work is really sort of underrated as a necessary component of learning, because it's how you actually persevere. It's how you get through that initial point of frustration or confusion. And this is as obvious but also counterintuitive as you can imagine. If there's something that confuses you, that's actually the first step towards insight. And the second step towards insight is perseverance. And so do the work to stick with that confusion, to look at it from all sides, to find the opening, which will then provide you the insight, which will then provide you the moment of breakthrough. And so often people, when they're young and they're in their sort of growing up as a student or growing up in school, and they find that a task is easy, then they sort of skate through it without having to learn that perseverance or without having to practice that perseverance. And then, frankly, for people when they get out into the professional world and they encounter a moment of frustration or a moment of confusion, they haven't necessarily practiced the notion of sticking with it and getting through it, which is ultimately the thing that's going to really drive success as a student.
I love that framework for learning. It's obvious that you've thought through that, and just because I think it is unconventional, right? If you think something is easy and you just get it immediately, you'd be like, oh, okay, I've learned that. But it really starts with that frustration. So can you talk a little bit, kind of going off of that? You mentioned you're teaching first-time entrepreneurs. Can you just lay over that framework, how you talk about this with them?
Sure. So with a first-time entrepreneur, and frankly, the same is true for repeat entrepreneurs, but I think actually in their cases, the direction of the learning is actually a little bit different, and we can talk about that. But with a first-time entrepreneur, there's just a series of unknown unknowns. And in fact, on some level, the whole beauty of being in a startup is to uncover unknown unknowns at an accelerating rate. So to ask smarter and smarter and smarter questions of a given problem space, and to do that via products, and to do that via experience and service. And so figuring out, first of all, the method by which you uncover those unknown unknowns is actually really important. And so one thing that a number of my peers in the venture business, for example, Josh Koppelman at Birchong Capital, who's a longtime mentor, will say is that he looks at the very early stages when he's evaluating a business, and then frankly, even when he's working with them, at the pace at which they are executing on certain sets of milestones, but also the pace at which they're learning. And that pace is really important because it's demonstrative that they have designed a framework for getting through and asking smarter questions. And that framework is the sort of initial input that you want to design for. And so what is that framework? And that framework has a couple of different criteria, but one of them is to have a set of hypotheses. Frankly, the scientific method is a really good structure for this. And so have a set of hypotheses, and then find a way of sort of with a high level of intellectual honesty and sort of community integrity, which I'll describe, prosecuting those hypotheses. So figuring out whether or not they're right. And when I say community integrity, what you need is accountability. And so when you have an hypothesis, for example, that a user will want X, or that a market problem can be solved by a Y, or even that a piece of a technical piece of product that currently has not had a solution could be solved via X method. What you need is to make sure that you're communicating with stakeholders in a very clear and, to the extent possible, metrics-driven way about what you're testing, so that as you're testing it, you know whether or not you found the answer. And so that intellectual honesty about what you're actually looking for is really key. And then once you've figured out the test, then on the basis of whether or not your hypothesis has been proven correct or not, how quickly can you either integrate that new information into your next test? And so that's the sort of soup to nuts framework, and you want to design that framework really well. So for example, if you're designing a company that I recently worked with called Heartbeat Health that is working on a cardiovascular disease management software, what they're trying to figure out as one of their initial go-to-market questions was whether or not people who were asymptomatic, and so who didn't already exhibit some sort of a symptom, whether it were chest pain or some of the things that typically are associated with heart health, whether they weren't, if they weren't symptomatic, whether or not they would still have a motivational pathway to go in and see a cardiologist. And so the most important thing in figuring out whether or not that is a test that's worth running is to design a hypothesis that you could actually know whether or not the hypothesis is true. And so one of our hypotheses was, well, gosh, it just hasn't been framed in the right way. And so if we were to frame it differently, then that framing would result in people being more likely to go see a cardiologist. And one of the framings is actually your primary care practitioner is very well suited to express to you the urgency or express to you the value of getting your heart checked earlier. But a lot of primary care practitioners are really busy. And so let's see if we can design a very specific test just for primary care practitioners to close the loop between them recognizing this as an issue, sharing it with a patient, and then the patient making a decision on the basis of what they've shared. And that's very specific, very tactical. You can measure each step along the way such that when that experiment is run, you can know with a funnel where there are conversion metrics at each step along the way, where there are drop-offs, and that's high fidelity information that you can then use to have asked a better question the next time, right? And so that's the type of process that you want to really get somebody in the mindset of designing around so many of their go-to-market experiences, because that's how you're ultimately going to be able to sort of stumble your way into true insight.
So just when you're talking about that, it really reminds me, and I think you mentioned it in there, where you create the hypothesis and then you're basically just testing against that. But I guess the question I have is, if there's so many things that you possibly could measure, but only probably a few really do the heavy lifting. So how do you narrow down and focus on which metrics matter the most?
Excellent question. So there's two answers I'll give you. The first answer is it's not just which metrics matter the most, but which tests are worth designing in the first place. And so the science, I think, is making sure you've got a process by which you actually can measure with high fidelity. And so the truth of the matter, with a lot of really, really interesting tests that one could design and frankly should design, is you won't really be able to measure the results. And so if you can't measure the results, even if the test is great, the point of the test is actually really limited because you're not going to be able to close the loop. And so the science is really making sure your measurement tools, whether they are analytics, if you're building something in a certain software category, or it's designing a user test of a small enough sample set that you can really understand what each user has gained out of the experience, or even if it's just right-sizing the test so you can collect the data in an efficient manner, the science really comes down to designing a measurement process that's really high quality. But I think the art is which tests should you run. And so some tests are better to run than others, and that's highly subjective and super dependent on a variety of conditions, including whether or not you as the entrepreneur, or you as the sort of experimenter, or as the scientist in this framework, have the right capacity to set up all the right outputs so that you really know the measurements. A, B, whether or not on the basis of the information you find, you'll be able to act on it. And so are you going to be able to either commercialize the information that you find, or are you going to be able to scale the sort of closed loop that results in a hypothesis being true? And those are things that are highly subjective and dependent on who the entrepreneur is. And so when I'm evaluating whether or not to work with somebody, and even as I'm evaluating the sort of quality of their ideas, it's not just the test they're designing in a vacuum, but it's the test they're designing in the context of who they are and how well they can measure those tests and how well they can measure the results of those tests. And so I think you need to really think about the beginning in terms of who's doing the work and the end in terms of how well you know whether that work has been done.
Gotcha. So would you mind just talking about that in context of either Heartbeat Health or maybe one of the companies that you were looking at the Collaborative Fund, just that idea of that two-part system that you just talked about?
Gladly. So maybe I'll give a specific example of another company that I enjoyed working with and have enjoyed continually working with, which is a company called Tala. They're actually based down in Southern California. They're in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they are a suite of financial services and an Android-based network, which allows you to create a credit score on the basis of a whole new set of inputs. And the way they do that is they work with mobile money operators like M-Pesa in Kenya and the equivalent in the Philippines, in Tanzania, in Mexico, all over the world. And they read from the Android device your transaction data, but they also will read they'll get a sense for your contact list, and they'll get a sense for where you tend to go over the course of a day, and they can create a spot, highly specified credit score that sort of moves in real time and adjusts on the basis of your needs. And that can allow them to do really, really targeted microcredit for people who are unbanked. And this is a software that, they've originated hundreds and hundreds of millions of loans over the course of their time. And when we started working with them at the very, very beginning of their journey, they hadn't designed this product or, frankly, any real products to figure out how to solve the microcredit problem for the unbanked. And so they had to go into scientist mode and put together great experiments. They had to discover which particular set of products would result in product market fit. And so in terms of the who, that was a really important input for me as an investor. So Shivani Saroya, who's the CEO and founder of the company, had worked in banking. She was born in India. She grew up in New York City and had worked in microfinance and had a deep understanding of the nature of a microfinance customer. And so her first experiment was actually an accounting tool that was targeted at Indian farmers. And this was Indian farmers who were not only unbanked, but likely didn't have access to smartphones. And so the idea would be to build an accounting tool, which would just be feature phone based, so strictly via SMS, be able to input and get some basic accounting information on the basis of keywords like A for apples and G for grain and B for bananas over the course of some harvest. And so she designed that experiment and she time bound it. And the time bounding it was a very important thing for her because one of her constraints was resources. She didn't have a lot of money to work with and she couldn't run this experiment and tweak each aspect of it indefinitely. And so she time bounded it to such a point where it was a short enough period of time that she could keep it very resource, limited and efficient, but a long enough piece of time that she could take some of her anecdotal understanding of these habits and actually put together a full accounting cycle. And so that was the first version of the experiment. And she found out pretty quickly that it didn't have uptake. And it didn't have uptake for a variety of reasons, but the simplest reason was because the input, manual input, was actually too hard. It took too much work to figure out the coding system and to write down each piece of that code and to transliterate it from wherever you had manually written all of your ongoing figures to create this accounting tool. So then she very, very quickly, as in maybe the next day, moved on to another experiment. And she decided at that point that she would run two experiments concurrently. And so it was just a sign. And as you sort of hear that type of operational approach, you get a sense for somebody who, A, has the right context that you can trust that they're going to design experiments well. B, is taking sort of optimal outputs for measurement in terms of time bounding it, in terms of what metrics she's looking for, what's going to be a sort of green light metric versus a yellow light metric versus a red light metric, and then what to do when you get to the endpoint. And so she continued to do this over the course of a period of about a year until she designed a product that ultimately ended up being the core of where her business is today. And it's called Mkopo Rahisi. And the way she did it was she said, well, one of the major constraints in, frankly, so many of the interesting interventions I'm trying to bring to bear in this space is this notion of efficiency of being able to input the data. And so how do you make it more efficient? Where is there already some sort of passive data stream that exists that I can just ingest and use software and automate the sort of underwriting or automate the analytics or automate some aspect of the experience to be able to return to the consumer something useful? And that's when she stumbled upon this mobile money insight, where she realized, oh, okay, on the basis of mobile money, I can build you a credit score from scratch in 2.5 minutes. And so she did one version of that test in Kenya. And by the end of that month, she was growing 20% a week, and the rest of it is history. And so that's the sort of an example of designing a really great test, not just in terms of the metrics, but also in terms of the context, and making sure when you measure something and you see that it's not working, be clear with yourself and clear with your accountability partners to cut the cord and move on to the next thing, right? And so that's, I think, the type of framework and the type of go-to-market and product development process that I'm really excited about walking future sets of entrepreneurs with and continuing to work with entrepreneurs around.
Yeah, that's super clear. That's an awesome example. So this idea of constant experimentation, that's obviously a really important part of being an entrepreneur. And with you working with a lot of entrepreneurs, are there any other qualities that you're looking for that when you see that, you're like, oh, I really want to work with that person?
Yes, absolutely. One that jumps out actually as a big one that often gets undervalued by the chattering class, so to speak, is somebody who's a systems thinker and somebody who can be highly systematic about how to approach a problem. And the way I like to think about this is if you had to do sort of science or math heavy problem sets in high school or in college, but there are some people who would approach the problem set and would have scrawl paper all over their desk and would be scrawling in 10 different corners all at once, just trying to get a better understanding, get their bearings of how to attack the problem. And once they were attacking the problem, keeping track of where different figures were held, where different values were held, which constants were where. And there are other people who were able to keep it on one page, maybe even have the same amount of information ultimately written down, but were highly organized about how they did it. And that is the type of person that I actually think has the right qualities to be an entrepreneur. And there's exceptions for every rule, particularly in early stage entrepreneurship. And so I don't mean to sort of be overly prescriptive, but that's one of the things that I tend to look at. And another maybe anecdote that I like to use to think about that is somebody who was able to attend a very competitive law school, but did not perform well on the LSAT the first time. And the reason that I think that's interesting is if you didn't perform well on the LSAT the first time, on whatever basis, it was hard for you. And were you able to create a system to improve your output? Were you able to create a system to solve the things that you were good at? Were you able to sort of ingest and close the feedback loop with those learnings and make those learnings more productive, but explicitly doing so in a manner where being hyper-organized and being able to keep a lot of information in your head at once and being able to be hyper-organized about how you deploy that information, whether it's in your essays or in your logic games or whatever is encapsulated in the LSAT, is a sign in my mind also of being able to be the right type of systems thinker for being an entrepreneur. And the reason why the systems thinking is so important is because what entrepreneurship really is a question of bringing certainty and or bringing at minimum a well-researched plan to a circumstance of extreme and maximum uncertainty. And so when you're an entrepreneur, you start with an infinite number of questions and somewhere that rounds down to zero number of hypotheses and almost no evidence. And what you need to do over the course of the go-to-market and the product market fit design process is to come up with hypotheses and then tests and then outcomes that will result in a plan that you can then hire an organization to execute against. And so what you really need to do is create systems for bringing certainty into uncertainty. And somebody who can take, for example, a problem set that starts off effectively as gibberish and try and extract some level of a plan for how to attack that problem set, or somebody who can take, even if it's not necessarily natural to them, something like a logic game or something like a reasoning test or something like and can turn that into a process by which they get better at it, is the right type of person in my mind, because even if they may not have the perfect product insight, they'll have a well-designed process that'll increase their chances of having a really good plan. And having a really good plan, if you are a startup founder, is really underrated, not because you're going to stick to that plan, but it's because as you continually go through your process, accountability is going to be so much easier. Recruiting is going to be so much easier. Knowing when things are working is going to be so much easier because your plan is going to effectively be the anchor around which all these other questions revolve.
So you mentioned two things that I think in Silicon Valley, just like very casual vocabulary, but I'd like you to define them a little bit more just to kind of expand on that. So systems thinking and product market fit.
Yes, gladly. Well, let me start with product market fit. And product market fit, first of all, the definition is not a technical one, which is to say that everybody who thinks about product market fit has a different perspective on it. My favorite definition of product market fit is you know it when you see it. But a maybe more descriptive definition is the point at which you have made something, whether it's a product or a service, that people want, for which there is organic demand, which is to say, for which there is demand that is driven by word of mouth or that is driven without you having to pay for it. Now, oftentimes when you hit product market fit, you are paying for that demand, which is to say you are marketing and advertising and trying to persuade people to use your products. But if you have product market fit, once they use it, they're highly, highly, highly likely to tell somebody else about it. And that then creates this virtuous cycle, which will create an organic growth feedback loop that will then allow your product to hit that type of exponential curve, which is what so many venture style businesses in Silicon Valley are hoping for. As for the first question, systems thinking, this one perhaps does have a somewhat more descriptive definition, but the way I simply think about it is, do you have a framework that applied across a variety of circumstances can be explained to somebody else and that other person could look at that framework and apply it reasonably well themselves? And if so, then I think you have some sort of a systems thinking capacity, which is to say, when you think about the way that the world works, instead of reacting intuitively, reacting via your gut, and even resulting with the right decisions, and even maybe having a subconscious framework or a subconscious set of systems that you deploy, if you can't replicate that, and or if you can't show it to somebody else and they can't replicate it, then I think you're not necessarily a systems thinker. And so that's how I would think about it.
Yeah, thank you just for those expansions. So for systems thinking, I think it's really just a fascinating topic, because do you think that some people are naturally born as systems thinkers, or how do you actually get better at that?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that question deeply. So this is, an extemporaneous answer, but what I would suggest is, just like almost any cognitive pathways, habits can be developed. And as you develop those habits, they can allow you to get better at one thing or another. And so I think that systems thinking can frankly be something you can be habituated to. I think some people may have more of a natural inclination to it than others, but I think everybody can solve for it, which is to say, as an example of this, to go back to the math example, there are so many systems that we become habituated to when we're thinking about math, that if we're solving a big, hairy, complex problem set, we may be using the Pythagorean theorem, which is a system by which you can deduct the other sides of a triangle if you know two or something like that. Or we may be using a system that we've used constantly to carry the number over when we're doing raw arithmetic. Or we may be using a system to estimate the derivative. And so in the course of solving a problem, there's a whole series of these systems which we've actually been trained in, which we've actually developed habits around, that we employ in some cases subconsciously, but often consciously, so as to be able to create some order out of, how do you make sense of some really complex, abstract, mathematical problem. Let me just say one further thing on that, Ryan, which is I think, a friend of mine, a gentleman named William Barker over at Camelot Partners, a really interesting hedge fund, he said this, which was, we are creatures of habit, and we have habits whether or not we intentionally do. And so we might as well think as hard as we can about designing habits that will allow us to hack our brains to the destination we want them to go in, which is to say that every single day we go into these habituated pathways that reinforce certain habits of our brain and move those from our sort of conscious brain to our unconscious brain. And to the extent that we can move things to our unconscious brain that are going to be more productive in the future, or that are going to allow us to replicate successful activities, or that will allow us to, to find ways to uncover unknown unknowns more quickly, for example, like that's that's the intentionality that I think one should be thinking about if they want to become a better systems thinker. And there's all sorts of specific ways one can do that.
Whoa, I love that quote. And just to go off that, usually my last question for people is, what are their daily habits? But I might as well just throw that in there right now. So are there any daily habits that you kind of do to move from conscious to subconscious?
Yes, I do too. I do a gratitude exercise at the end of the day with my wife and my little son, where we go through all the things we're grateful for. And at the beginning of the day, I do a sort of intentions and gratitude exercise just with myself, where I talk through what I want to accomplish today, the type of person I want to be today. And sometimes they're hyper specific and sometimes they're hyper general. So sometimes I just want to be healthy and sometimes I'm just grateful for my health. And sometimes it's I want to walk at all of my meetings today, and or it's I want to maintain eye contact because I feel as though I haven't done a great job of it. And what that does is it just gets me into a sort of to the point of designing experiments, an input and an output relationship where I'm controlling the intentions at the beginning of the day and I'm measuring the outcomes at minimum just by reflecting on them at the end of the day. And so it creates a really nice structure for me to be able to control the energy that I'm putting out in the world.
Interesting. So how do you keep all that stuff in your mind if you, because I was just thinking if I were to do that, I would probably have like 10 different things that I would keep trying to think of. So how do you focus that?
It's not comprehensive. And that's kind of the point. And so the things that I naturally, when I reflect, am grateful for, will change over the course of the day. But by making sure I do it as a daily habit, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to move certain aspects of my life that I'm grateful for into sort of habit, and I'm trying to move it into unconscious mind. And so I explicitly don't, at the end of the day, write those ones down. At the beginning of the day, however, I do write them down. And the reason I write them down is because I want to remember them over the course of 24 hours or however many hours I'm awake to the extent that I can. And so I write them down at the beginning. I usually just use either pen and paper, depending on my mood, or sometimes I'll use the notes app in my iPhone, and I'll just write down, you know, 5 to 6 things that are intentions and or points of gratitude and or usually sort of general personal goals over the course of the day. And then at the end of the day, when we do our sort of gratitude, and the gratitude actually, I think, is maybe the most powerful thing for me, because it really is a way of changing your perspective. And one of the greatest ways of being able to create insight is to look at something from a different angle. Because when you look at it from a different angle, you suddenly see aspects of it that you weren't seeing before. And this is, you know, basic physics. It's the dark side of the moon, right? And so when you do a gratitude exercise, what you're trying to do is step out of your reality and look at the world somewhat differently. Look at the world with an appreciative lens specifically. And what that often actually does for me is it brings me a moment of insight, or actually an inspiration for how I can solve whatever the blocker is over the course of the day.
Gotcha. So just on the last podcast episode, we had a guy on named Ryan Kruger, who's a financial advisor in Texas. And his final piece of advice was that we should have appreciation instead of expectation. And so I think that just goes along with that. So what's something that's maybe on the top of your mind? Because you said this isn't comprehensive, but you've been thinking about a lot of things lately. So what's that one thing you're trying to move into the subconscious right now?
Great question. The one thing I'm trying to move into the subconscious right now is this notion of, so one of the interesting things about being an early stage investor and particularly a seed stage investor is that you have to be able to do what I refer to as, or what I understand to be integrative thinking, where you're taking two contradictory viewpoints and you're considering them as true at the same time. And in the particular case of the integrative thinking you need to do at early stage startups, there's a myriad set of examples, but the one that I constantly have to think about is when I have high conviction about a startup, two things are true. I know on the basis of statistics that that company is probably going to go out of business. And I also know on the basis of the strength of my convictions that that company is probably going to change the world and become massive. And I have to consider those both as true if I'm going to be a rational steward of capital and if I'm going to be a rational investor. And so what I'm really trying to do is just develop a better instinct at not getting bounced back and forth between those two things, but rather just having them both be true at the same time. And I actually think that's something that can be a matter of habit. And so sometimes, and again, this is maybe a long-term ongoing exercise for me, but I sometimes will go from high conviction to this is never going to work, to high conviction to this is never going to work. And then ultimately I end up deciding if I make an investment, I'm going to make the investment because I'm high conviction right now. And so let me make the decision right now. But that's obviously not the most productive way to do it. The most productive way to do it is I'm high conviction even while I accept that it may not work. And I really think that just takes practice. And I'm, you know, at the beginning of year 8 of doing this, and I still feel like I need a lot of practice in that effort.
If I'm not mistaken, that is a pinned tweet on your Twitter, right? That ability to hold contradictory viewpoints?
Once again, I'm trying to make sure it enters my subconscious. So I want to see it as much as possible.
It's funny that you brought that up because that was actually one of the questions that I had for you. Because this especially, I think, is so important because it's unconventional and so hard to kind of wrap your brain around. So can you just give us a few examples of, I like that example you're talking about with conviction and just statistics, but are there any other examples that you have?
Well, there's another example actually in my personal life, and then I'll go back to an example in my business life. But in a personal life, one of the interesting things about child rearing is that there's the past dependencies on being able to be a successful parent are infinitely complex. There's just so many different ways that it's impossible to sort of bring out true clarity from what the pathway is that's going to result in even your goals, but most certainly not your children's happiness, except for one thing, which is if you don't care, then you will have a negative impact on their life. And so it is true that if you care, it doesn't matter. And it is also true that you have to care. And so what I have to think about when I'm making decisions about my child is, oh gosh, I'm slaving over this decision, but the fact that I'm slaving over it means the decision itself probably doesn't matter. And that's a really tricky thing because you want to be able to hold both of those truths in your mind at the same time, because you can't give up the decision and not care, because then you get into a habit of not being able to put sufficient thought into the decisions relating to your child's development in life. But on the other hand, even if you put all the care in the world into it, who knows what's going to happen? It's impossible to deduce. And frankly, the fact that you're caring is enough. And so that's one example that I might point to in personal life. In professional life, one thing that I would point to maybe speaks somewhat of the notion of how bidding psychology works with humans in general, but certainly with venture capitalists, which is this notion that a deal tends to be more attractive when you have thought it out, you have pitched, and you have been successful in your pitch. I actually think that we, all of us, are happier when we can close a sale than when a sale gets closed on us, so to speak. And so what that means, when it comes to fundraising, when it comes to recruiting, when it comes even to regular sales, is there's a combination of being sort of forward and clear and trying to make your case to the other party, but there's also this equally important element of not being too available so that you can give that person the satisfaction of closing the deal. And now this is a sort of delicate art. And there's many ways that this can get done wrong and many ways that this can get done unproductively. And as a specific example, you can tell if an entrepreneur is playing hard to get just for the sake of playing hard to get. And that is immediately a huge turnoff. Whereas if an entrepreneur is genuinely interested in understanding why you are the right partner for them rather than anybody else, and you then have an opportunity to sell yourself, you're already more predisposed to working with that person because you've just pitched them. And so there's actually a really interesting element there where, you know, you have to, when you're looking for money, you have to do the opposite, which is why you have to sort of frame yourself as somebody who is being pitched rather than somebody who is pitching, because it'll make your own pitch more successful. And it's a little bit of a counterintuitive dance, but I consistently see it over and over again when I see great sales processes, whether it's closing a sale, closing a hire, or closing a funding round, that entrepreneurs benefit from when they really can strike that balance well.
Thanks for that. Those are two great examples. Don't want to take up too much time, but I have two questions to kind of wrap things up. So we've been talking about frameworks and systems thinking, and how I was talking about at the beginning, your path is pretty unconventional. So if you don't mind, can we talk about maybe your frameworks for making decisions, whether that was dropping out of Stanford or even leaving the Collaborative Fund, just maybe some of those frameworks?
Totally. So maybe we'll start from when I decided to leave the fund. So I left the fund after a very, very enjoyable almost 7 years. And the reasons for my leaving were, A, I wanted to try my hand at really working with extremely early emerging entrepreneurs and seeing if I could be, to harken back to the beginning of this conversation, more of a teacher, more of a coach. And that coaching was, in my mind, predicated on an ability to be even earlier in the germination cycle of a startup, even earlier in the trajectory of a founder putting together their opportunity, even then seed stage. And I actually believe that seed stage, particularly the way that it's structured in today's market, is not even that close to the earliest point where an entrepreneur could benefit from some outside guidance and even some outside capital. So I really wanted to try my hand at that. And then the second thing that I really wanted to try my hand at as well was applying some of the things that I had been trying to frame for others on myself. And so I wanted to go through the founder journey myself, and I wanted to see what it would be like to sort of start from scratch and to start from extreme uncertainty and an infinite litany of unknowns and find processes by which I could uncover insight, uncover direction, and uncover things that people in the market organically wanted. And so it was really, really valuable for me to get to do both of those things, because now I feel like I have some level of conviction around what it means to be a coach and a mentor at the very earliest stages of an entrepreneur's journey. I have a really sort of strong and maybe even strident point of view about the criteria that'll make an entrepreneur successful at the early stage. I have what I might think are even a few contrarian points of view about how risk works at the very earliest stages of a startup. And those things, I think I really only was able to lean into and fully feel convicted about in being independent and being a founder myself. And as for prior decisions, a part of why the system thinking and the framework design and this method of applying real principle and process to life design is so interesting to me is I actually didn't design my life this way. And so my initial decision to drop out of Stanford, my subsequent decision to work on a startup and work for Obama's campaign and work on another startup and then eventually go back to Stanford, all of those decisions were kind of following my nose, following my gut. And I'm so grateful for every one of those experiences because they really shaped me and taught me a lot about the world, about what I was passionate about, and about how to work in an innovative landscape. But when I got back to Stanford, I became a part of a class where I was first a student in it, and then I was on the teaching team for a class called Designing Your Life. And in that class, what I really started to think about was, what does it look like to actually bring design to your life? And what does it look like to bring this method of start with a hypothesis and design tests that you can actually measure and have a point of view and make sure that point of view is one that you really have sort of internal alignment with and that is directed by your natural curiosity and make sure that process you can run it efficiently and within the constraints of your personal circumstance. And so a lot of these things I actually developed later in life. And so part of why I'm so passionate about them is because I'm relatively new to them.
So I feel like I could ask questions for another more hour just after what you said, but I don't want to be respectful of your time. So I was just doing some research on just your background and other things, and I came upon your LinkedIn profile. So a couple people had high praise for you, and I want to add a question after I read them out. So one person said, I recommend Kanye unconditionally. Another person said, people gravitate towards him more easily than anyone I've ever met. And another person said, I would work with him on any endeavor. So why did these people say this?
Oh, gosh. I don't know, man. Because I paid them to. No, I'm kidding. I guess if there's something that I bring that's unique, is I am pretty enthusiastic, and I'm pretty enthusiastic in part because I focus on stuff that I genuinely care about. And so I try not to, you know, I try to really follow my natural curiosity and let that natural curiosity drive the direction of my life and not think about my life so much in terms of what I should be doing, but rather in terms of what I'm really excited about and what I'm proud of and what I think I'll be proud of when I'm old. And so I'm just really passionate about my life and I'm really passionate about the stuff I'm doing. And I think that authentic passion is almost always, you know, net contagious. I think other people become more passionate too. And so I, you know, when I think about how I work best with others, it's really just a capacity to put my own enthusiasm for my work right next to their work and hope that that'll inspire them to bring that similar enthusiasm.
That's awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure kind of picking your brain, and thank you so much, Kanye.
Ryan, this was wonderful. And thank you so much for the podcast. I'm a big fan. I started listening when you reached out, and so far I'm through 4 episodes, but I'm going to cover them all shortly.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, take care, Ryan.
Thanks again for listening. You can find more information at www.investingcity.org, where you can sign up and subscribe for our email newsletter that goes out every Tuesday and Friday. And you can also follow us on basically every social media platform on the face of the earth. And if you're feeling extra generous, please leave us an iTunes review, as it really helps us out. And with that, have a fantastic day.